Chapter 57. The shock and disappointment showed clearly in Amar's eyes when he realized the glacial front was not about to fall. He whirled to face Eben. "What went wrong?" he demanded, his voice ragged with growing anger. "There should have been a chain of explosions." Eben's face was like stone. "You know me well, Suleiman Aziz. I do not make mistakes. The explosives should have detonated. The commando team we saw drop from the glacier to the ship must have found and disarmed most of them." Amar stared briefly at the sky, threw up his hands, and let them drop again. "Allah weaves strange patterns into our lives," he said philosophically. Then a slow smile spread across his lips. "The glacier may fall yet. Once our helicopter is airborne, we can make a pass and drop grenades into the ice fracture." Eben matched Amar's smile. "Allah has not deserted us," he said reverently. "Do not forget we are safe here on shore while the Mexicans have inherited the job of fighting the Americans." "Yes, you're right, old friend. We're in Allah's debt for our well-timed deliverance." Amar stared contemptuously at the ship. "We'll soon see if Captain Machado's Aztec gods can protect him." "He was a maggot, that one." Suddenly Eben stopped and cocked an ear, then gazed up the mountain slope. "Gunfire coming from the mine." Amar listened, but he heard something else. The distant cry of the locomotive's whistle. The sound was continuous and grew louder. Then he saw the plume of smoke and watched in sudden puzzlement as the train shot down the mountainside, careening wildly on the curving switchbacks before barreling across a long, straight stretch toward the pier. "What are those fools doing?" Amar gasped as he saw the train thundering wildly down the track, heard the whistle filling the pre-dawn with its high-pitched scream. The hijackers and their hostages were not prepared for the incredible spectacle now avalanching upon them like a monster on a rampage. They stood petrified in disbelieving fascination. "Allah save us," a man uttered in a hoarse voice. "Save yourself," Eben snapped. He was the first to recover, and he began shouting for everyone to clear the tracks. There was bedlam as everyone scattered away from the rails just as the ore cars, pulled by the out-of-control little engine, her drive rods whipping in blurred motion, shot onto the pier. The wooden pilings and flooring shuddered at the sudden onslaught. The tail-end ore car bounced off the tracks, but, held by its coupling, was dragged like a screaming unruly child by his ear across the tarred planking. Clouds of sparks sprayed as the steel wheels clattered against the rails. Then the engine ran out of track and soared off the end of the pier. The train seemed to arc through the air for an instant in slow motion before the engine finally dropped and dived into the fjord. Miraculously, the boiler failed to explode when its heated walls met the icy water. The engine vanished with a great hiss and a cloud of steam, followed by a loud grinding of tortured metal as the ore cars piled in on top of each other. Amar and Eben dashed to the pier's end and stared helplessly at the bubbles and steam rising from the water. "The bodies of our men were hanging from the cab," said Amar. "Did you see them?"
"I did, Suleiman Aziz."
"The sound of gunfire you heard a minute ago," Amar said in a white rage. "Our men must be under attack at the mine. There is still a chance to escape if we hurry and help them before the helicopter is damaged." Amar paused only long enough to give orders for one of his men to bring up the rear with the prisoners. He set off up the narrow gauge tracks at a half run, the other members of his hijacking force trailing behind in single file. Growing fear and uncertainty swelled inside Amar's mind. If the helicopter was destroyed, there could be no escape, no place to hide on the barren island. The American Special Forces would hunt them down one by one, or leave them either to freeze or starve to death. Amar was determined to survive, if for no other reason than to kill Yazid, and find the devil who was responsible for hounding him to Santa Inez Island and devastating his intricate plans. The sounds of the battle increased and reverberated down the mountain. He was panting heavily from the exertion of running uphill, but he gritted his teeth and increased his pace. Captain Machado was standing in the wheelhouse when he heard, felt really, the muted detonation on the glacier. He stiffened for a moment, listening, but the only sound was the light tick of a large 8-day clock above the bridge windows. Then his face suddenly paled. The glacier, he thought, it must be ready to break off. Machado hurried to the communications room and found one of his men staring dumbly at the teletype. He looked up blankly at Machado's entrance.
"I thought I heard an explosion."
Suspicion unfolded inside Machado's gut.
Have you seen the radio men or the Egyptian leader?
I've seen no one.
No Arabs at all?
Not in the past hour.
The radar operator paused. I haven't seen any of them since I left the dining salon and came on duty. They should be guarding the prisoners and patrolling the outside deck, since those are the jobs they stupidly volunteered for.
Machado studied the empty chair at the radio thoughtfully.
Maybe they weren't so stupid.
He stepped to the counter in front of the helm and looked through the narrow view cuts in the plastic sheeting directly in front of the bridge windows. There was enough daylight now to clearly see the forward part of the ship. His eyes found several wide tears in the plastic. Too late he saw the ropes running from the top of the glacier down through the openings. Too late he swung around to voice an alarm over the ship's communication system. He came to a dead stop before he uttered a sound. There was a man standing in the doorway. A man who wore all-black dress. Hands and what little face that showed through the ski mask were also blackened. Night vision goggles hung around his neck. He wore a large bulletproof chest piece with several pockets and clips holding both fragmentation and stun grenades, three murderous-looking knives, and a number of other killing devices. Machado's eyes suddenly squinted. "Who are you?" he demanded, knowing full well he was staring at death. As he spoke, he made a lightning snatch of a 9mm automatic pistol from a shoulder holster and snapped off a shot. Machado was good. Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and Bat Masterson would have been proud of him. His shot struck the intruder square in the center of the chest. With older bulletproof vests, the pure force behind the blow could snap a rib or stop a heart. The vests worn by the SOF men, however, were the latest state-of-the-art. They could even stop a .308 NATO round and distribute the impact so it left only a bruise. Dillinger shuddered slightly from the bullet, took one step back, and pulled the trigger of his Heckler and Koch all in the same motion. Machado wore a vest, too, but the older model. Dillinger's burst tore through and riddled his chest. His spine arched like a tightly strung bow, and he staggered backward, falling against the captain's chair before dropping to the deck. The Mexican guard raised his arms and shouted, "Don't fire! I am unarmed!" Dillinger's short burst into the throat cut off the Mexican's plea, knocking him into the ship's compass binnacle, where he hung suspended like a limp rag doll.
"Don't move or I'll shoot," Dillinger said belatedly.
Sergeant Foster stepped around the major and looked down at the dead terrorist. "He's dead, sir."
"I warned him," Dillinger said casually as he slipped another clip into his weapon.
Foster kicked the body over on its stomach with his boot. A long bayonet knife slipped out of a sheath below the collar and rattled on the deck.
"Intuition, Major?" asked Foster. "I never trust a man who says he's unarmed."
Suddenly Dillinger stopped and listened. Both men heard it at the same time and looked at each other, puzzled.
"What in hell is that?" asked Foster.
"They were a good 30 years before my time, but I'd swear that's a whistle from an old steam locomotive. Sounds like it's coming down the mountain from the old mine."
"I thought it was abandoned. The Numa people were to wait there until the ship was secure."
"Why would they stoke up an old locomotive?"
"I don't know."
Dillinger paused and stared distantly, a sudden certainty growing within him.
"Unless they're trying to tell us something."
The detonation on the glacier caught Hollis and his team in the dining salon immediately after a wild shootout. His dive team had sliced their way through the plastic and found a tight passage between the fake cargo containers. They had passed warily through a doorway into an empty bar and lounge outside the dining salon, fanned out, dodging behind pillars and furniture, four men covering the staircase and two elevators, and surprised Machado's Mexican terrorist team. All but one terrorist was down. He still stood where he'd been hit, hate and vague astonishment reflected in his dying eyes. Then his body collapsed and he fell to the carpet, staining its rich, thick pile a deep crimson. Hollis and his team advanced, warily stepping over and around the bodies. A blood-chilling creak of the ice wall sounded throughout the ship, rattling the few undamaged bottles and glasses behind an ornate bar. The special operations men stared uneasily at one another and at their colonel, but they stood firm and ready.
"Major Dillinger's team must have missed one," Hollis mused calmly.
"No hostages here, sir," said one of his men. "All appear to be terrorists." Hollis studied several of the lifeless faces. None of them looked like they came from the Middle East.
Must be the crew from the General Bravo, he thought. He turned away and pulled a copy of the ship's deck layout from a pocket and studied it briefly while he talked into his radio.
Major, report your status.
Met light resistance so far, replied Dillinger. Have only accounted for 4 hijackers. The bridge is secure and we've released over 100 crew members who were locked in the baggage hold. Sorry we didn't find all the charges.
Good work. You did well to disarm enough to keep the glacier from calving. I'm heading for the master staterooms to free the passengers. Request the engine room crew return to their station and restore power. We don't dare hang around under the ice cliff a minute longer than we have to. Watch yourselves. We took out another 16 hijackers, all Latins. There must be another 20 Arabs still on the ship.
They may be on shore, sir.
Why do you say that?
We heard a whistle from a locomotive a couple of minutes ago. I ordered one of my men to climb the radar mast and check it out. He reported a train roaring down the mountain from the mine like a bowling ball. He also observed it run off a nearby pier that was crowded with 24 terrorists.
Forget it for now. Let's rescue the hostages first and see to the shore when we've secured the ship.
Acknowledged. Hollis led his men up the grand staircase and moved, quiet as a whisper, into the hallway separating the staterooms. Suddenly they froze in position as one of the elevators hummed and rose from the deck below. The door opened and the hijacker stepped out, unaware of the assault. He opened his mouth, the only movement he was able to make, before one of Hollis's men tapped him heavily on the head with the silenced muzzle of his gun. Incredibly, there were no guards outside the staterooms. The men began kicking in the doors, and upon entering found the Egyptian and Mexican advisors and presidential staff aides, but no sign of Hassan and De Lorenzo. Hollis broke open the last door at the hallway, burst inside, and confronted 5 men in ship's uniforms. One of them stepped forward and gazed at Hollis in contempt.
"You might have used the door latch," he said, regarding Hollis with suspicion.
"You must be Captain Oliver Collins."
"Yes, I'm Collins, as if you didn't know."
"Sorry about the door. I'm Colonel Morton Hollis, Special Operations Forces."
"By Jesus, an American!" gasped First Officer Finney.
Collins's face lit up as he rushed forward to pump Hollis's hand.
"Forgive me, Colonel. I thought you might be one of them. Are we ever glad to see you?"
"How many hijackers?" asked Hollis.
"After the Mexicans came on board from the General Bravo, I should judge about 40.
"We've only accounted for 20.
Collins's face reflected the ordeal. He looked haggard but still stood tall.
"You've freed the 2 presidents and Senator Pitt and Miss Camille?"
"I'm afraid we haven't found them yet."
Collins rushed past him through the doorway.
"They were held in the master suite just across the passageway."
Hollis stood aside in surprise.
"No one in there," he said flatly. "We've already searched this deck."
The captain ran into the empty suite but saw only the rumpled bedclothes, the usual light mess left by passengers. His stiff-backed composure fell away, and he looked positively stunned.
"My God, they've taken them!"
Hollis spoke into his microphone.
"Major Dillinger."
Dillinger took 5 seconds to respond.
"I read you, Colonel. Go ahead."
"Any contact with the enemy?"
"None. I think we've pretty well rounded them up."
"At least 20 hijackers and the VIP passengers are missing. You see a sign of them?"
"Negative. Not so much as a stray hair."
"Okay, finish securing the ship and have her crew move her out into the fjord."
"No can do," said Dillinger solemnly.
"Problems?"
"The murdering bastards really did a number on the engine room. They smashed up everything. It'll take a week to put the ship back in operation."
"We've got no power at all?"
"Sorry, Colonel. Here we are and here we sit. These engines aren't taking us anywhere. They also wrecked the generators, including the auxiliaries."
"Then we'll have to take the crew and passengers off by lifeboat, using the manual winches."
"No go, Colonel. We're dealing with genuine sadists. They also trashed the lifeboats, bashed the bottoms out."
Dillinger's dire report was punctuated by a deep growling noise that emanated from the glacier and traveled through the ship like a drum. There was no vibration this time, only the growl that turned into a heart-stopping rumble. It lasted nearly a minute before it finally faded and died. Hollis and Collins were both brave men. No one would ever doubt it, but each read fear in the other's eyes.
"The glacier is ready to calve," said Collins grimly. "Our only hope is to cut away the anchor chains and pray the tide carries us out into the fjord."
"'Believe me, you won't see ebb tide for another 8 hours,' said Hollis. "'You're talking to a man who knows.'
"'You're just full of cheery news, aren't you, Colonel?'
"'Doesn't look encouraging, does it?'
"'Doesn't look encouraging,' Collins repeated. "'Is that all you have to say?'
"'There are nearly 200 people on board the Lady Flamborough. "'They must be evacuated immediately.'
"'I can't wave a wand and make the glacier go away,' Hollis explained calmly. "'I can take a few out in inflatable boats and call in our helicopters to airlift the rest, "'but we're talking a good hour.'
Collins's voice came edged with impatience. "'Then I suggest you get on with it while we're all still alive.'
He halted as Hollis abruptly swung up a hand for silence.
Hollis's eyes narrowed in bewilderment as a strange voice suddenly burst over his earphone.
"'Colonel Hollis, am I on your frequency? Over.'
"'Who the hell is this?' Hollis snapped.
"'Captain Frank Stewart of the Numa ship Sounder at your service. Can I give you a lift somewhere?'
"'Stewart!' the colonel burst out. "'Where are you?'
If you could see through all that crap hanging on your superstructure, you'd find me cruising up the fjord about half a kilometer off your port side.
Hollis exhaled a great sigh and nodded at Collins.
A ship is bearing down on us. Any instructions?
Collins stared at him, numb with disbelief.
Then he blurted, Good God, yes, man. Tell him to take us under tow.
Working feverishly, Collins's crew slipped the bow and stern anchor chains and made ready with the mooring hawsers. In a feat of superb seamanship, Stewart swung the Sounder's stern under the Lady Flamborough's bow in one pass. Two heavy rope mooring lines were dropped by the crewmen of the cruise ship and immediately made fast to the survey ship's deck bits. It was not the most perfect tow arrangement, but the ships were not going for distance across stormy seas. And the temporary expedient was accomplished in a matter of minutes. Stewart gave the command for slow ahead until the slack was taken up from the tow lines. Then he slowly increased speed to full ahead while he looked over his shoulder, one eye on the glacier, one on the cruise liner. The Sounder's two cycloidal propellers, one forward and one aft, thrashed the water as her great diesel engine strained under the load. She was half the Lady Flamborough's tonnage and never meant for tug duty, but she dug in and drove like a draft horse in a pulling contest, black exhaust pouring from her stack. At first, nothing seemed to happen. And then slowly, imperceptibly, a small bit of froth appeared around the Sounder's bow. She was moving, hauling the reluctant cruise liner from under the shadow of the glacier. Despite the danger, the passengers, crew, and Special Forces fighters all tore away the plastic sheeting and stood on the decks, watching and willing the struggling Sounder forward. 10 meters, then 20, 100. The gap between ship and ice widened with agonizing slowness. Then, at last, the Lady Flamborough was clear. Everyone on both ships gave a rousing cheer that echoed up and down the fjord. Later, Captain Collins would humorously call it the cheer that broke the camel's back. A loud cracking sound trailed the celebrating voices and grew into a great booming rumble. To those watching, it seemed as if the air was electrified. Then the whole forward face of the ice cliff toppled forward and pounded into the fjord like a huge oil tanker being launched on its side. The water seethed and boiled and rose in a 10-foot wave that surged down the fjord, and lifted the two ships like corks before heading out toward the open sea. The monstrous, newly calved iceberg settled into the deeply carved channel of the fjord, its ice glinting like a field of orange diamonds under the new sun. Then the rumble rolled down from the mountainside and echoed in the ears of the stunned onlookers, who couldn't believe they were somehow alive.